Hey, folks, we are here with episode 83 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. We have the always large and in charge Greg Everett, but more possibly importantly today, we have Chris Kresser, the investigative medicine guru, who's here today to talk to us about having healthy babies, pregnancy, and ubiquitous and fun breastfeeding. Chris, how are you?
I'm good, Rob. It's good to be back on the show.
I told Chris, I'm like, before we got ready to roll, I was like, so are you prepared to destroy your career? When we press play on this, it's all over. So
it'll be enjoyable, though.
You're brave for coming back, man.
Like I said, it was good while it lasted.
It's totally. I regret nothing. So folks loved you when you were on here before. So, you know, we're talking about this new product, a new system that Chris has put together related to fertility and dealing with infertility, growing a healthy baby, having a productive, successful breastfeeding and all that. But before we jump into the nuts and bolts of some of that stuff, I just wanted to relate a story. One of my first observations or kind of, you know, shocking revelations related to effective nutrition and lifestyle and how it can influence fertility. When we were in the maybe two locations previous, this was when Greg was still with us at NorCal, we had a client who was 44, 46 years old, I believe, had never been able to conceive, and started training with us, and then out of nowhere got pregnant.
It wasn't me.
And it was not Greg, right? Greg was not involved in that particular case. And what was interesting was that this gal had always had some polycystic ovarian syndrome, had always had some PMS-type symptoms. She and her husband had done the whole retinue of, like, reproductive medicine intervention without success. And then after literally maybe 4 weeks of training at the gym, and we had her eat some gluten-free, dairy-free, paleo foods, got her sleep nailed down, had her start exercising, and lo and behold, she got pregnant. And this was a shocker for everybody, and very quickly after this, we discovered that everybody was getting pregnant. And like, this is now, we just have this like ongoing flow of babies popping out of the gym. And again, like, I have nothing to do with that. I'll vouch for Greg.
And since it sounds like you got something to do with it.
just the coaching side, but there has been no DNA information
transfer.
But you know, last August alone, we had 12 or 15 births at NorCal Strength and Conditioning, and that's neglecting. Like,
that seems unsterile.
Maybe you should have a midwifery clinic, like, off on the side there.
We told, at the very least, like, some doula training or something like that.
Yeah. And strength trainer / doula.
Yeah, totally. It's the next thing. It'll be a 3-stage certification.
Right.
But, you know, this was just some really interesting, almost shocking stuff. And then when I've been doing the Paleo Solution Seminar, like, it's just this repeat kind of event where folks describe changing their diet, changing their lifestyle, and they had tons of reproductive health issues previously, whether it was the male or female. Issues that were both autoimmune and hyperinsulinemic mediated, and then some, you know, some other issues seemed to resolve. And so, like, I've had in the back of my head this need for some sort of a systematic approach to dealing with this, not just simply eat paleo, sleep, and exercise, and then it'll all work out. I mean, it works pretty well, but there's a lot more to it, as Chris is going to describe here. So, Chris, talk to us a little bit about how did this stuff get on your radar?
Like, yeah,
in investigative medicine and Chinese medicine and all that as kind of a primary base. How did this specifically get on your radar?
You know, like in most cases, it was a personal thing. So, my wife Alana and I started trying to get pregnant a couple of years ago, and it didn't happen immediately. And we're both, you know, we've both been eating like a paleo Weston A. Price type of diet for a long time. So, in our case, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't as simple as just switch to the paleo diet and get pregnant, although I do see that happening a lot, just like you're saying. In fact, maybe we need a warning on your book or something, because I've had quite a few unexpected pregnancies in my practice, you know, people that weren't trying to get pregnant and actually were not necessarily pleased that they got pregnant,
right,
when they switched to this diet. But yeah, so anyways, being the research dork that I am, when, you know, after a few, you know, several months had passed and we hadn't conceived, I just started to dive into the scientific literature and see what I could figure out about nutrient requirements for pregnancy, and maybe discovering some stuff that we were overlooking, even though I think our diets were really, really solid. So that's how I got into it. And then last October we conceived, and we're 8 weeks out here waiting. I mean, could be 6 weeks, could be 10 weeks, but pretty soon, yeah, I'm going to be a dad. So
what Chris is saying is that the middle of the night terror of being a father has set in upon him, where he's like, right in bed, and he's like, yeah, "Oh, Mother of God."
Rob and I talked about this the other day. It's like, yeah, all, very excited, and then there is that moment deep in the black of night, going, "What the hell is going to happen to my life?"
I promise that it's mostly cool.
That's what I hear. So. Yeah, so one of the surprises, though, for me, I mean, of course, if you say nutrition is important for pregnancy, I think most people would nod their head and say, yeah, of course. But I didn't realize just how important it was until I really got into this stuff and started looking at the research. And, I mean, traditional cultures knew this, and you know, if you look at traditional cultures, a lot of them had special diets for fertility, preconception period, like the Maasai people in Africa, for example, wouldn't even let couples get married or try to conceive before they had been drinking the milk from cows that had been grazing on green grass during a particular time of year, because they knew that that milk was nutrient dense and that it would help, you know, with conception. And we know now what those nutrients are. We're going to talk a little bit about those later. But even though traditional cultures have known this for a long time, the whole idea that nutrition is crucial during pregnancy and just how crucial it is has only, you know, recently been emphasized in modern medicine. And they call it, they actually, of course, have a name for it. It's the developmental origins theory. Sometimes it's called the developmental origins of health and disease, or DOHAD. You gotta love that acronym.
It sounds like a missile launching station or something.
Yeah, nuclear test. So, you know, basically what this theory holds is that the nutritional environment in the womb affects not only our health at birth and during early childhood, which I think is pretty obvious to most people, but also determines our lifelong risk for degenerative diseases like obesity, heart disease, and diabetes. And I think that part is what's surprising for most folks. So they go on.
And within this, basically what we have, you know, you have conception, you have egg and sperm come together, the DNA starts mixing, and as soon as that DNA starts mixing and we have cell replication that starts occurring, we have, if you were to think about this, maybe like if we're, you know, shooting an object into space or something like that, like the further away the distance, the more important the aim is for like hitting a particular target. And so the way that the DNA is being flipped on and off in that fetal developmental period has this massive ramification down the road. Like these are the epigenetic triggers which are going to influence everything from like susceptibility, like Chris said, to cancer, diabetes, heart disease, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. Like tons of different things are being set up right in utero, and can be modified to some degree later in life. Chris and I were talking about this a couple of days ago, but it's so much better and so critical to get this stuff right from the get-go.
Yeah, absolutely. And there really is one chance. And of course, it can, like you said, it can be modified later. But that what we're seeing is that the 9 months during pregnancy is probably the most consequential period of our lives when it comes to determining our health. And, you know, we know that what's happening in the womb can do everything from permanently influence the wiring of the brain and the functioning of organs like the heart and the liver and the pancreas, And it can shape everything from, like you said, our susceptibility to disease, but also our appetite and metabolism, and our intelligence and temperament. I just saw a study come out recently. It's called Fetal Programming of Autonomic and HPA Function. Do people who are small babies have enhanced stress responses? So that study was looking at the relationship between low birth weight and then, compromised stress tolerance that extends later, all the way down into the adult years. There are studies that show that babies that are born underweight are more likely to suffer from heart disease before the age of 65. There's studies that show that low birth weight babies, which, this is primarily influenced by nutrition during pregnancy, have higher rates of asthma and allergies and, like you said, other autoimmune diseases. So it's a pretty big deal, and it's something that I think is still pretty poorly understood in the mainstream. And you hear doctors and people saying, yeah, eat well during pregnancy, but that's pretty much where it ends. There's not much discussion beyond that.
Right. And something that, it's a touchy subject because folks can get into like a blame game with this stuff. And when we're, I guess something to maybe state up front is that, this is just trying to recommend like the best case scenario. If you are already pregnant, if you've already had a kid, if the nutrition was suboptimal, there's other stuff you can do, but this is just basically heading into this thing with eyes open, trying to be as cognizant of it and kind of stack the deck in our favor if at all possible. So,
yeah, exactly. And yeah, I want to reiterate that too. I mean, the fact is we're really fragile as humans, but we're also pretty resilient. So even in suboptimal conditions, it's possible to have a healthy baby. And there are a lot of women around the world delivering healthy babies in suboptimal conditions. So what we're talking about here is, like you said, Rob, how to just absolutely maximize your chances of having the healthiest baby you can have, and also maintaining your own health, throughout pregnancy and the breastfeeding period.
Right.
So,
Chris, in your program, you have 5 common myths about nutrition, fertility, and pregnancy related to kind of nutrient intake and stuff like that. Can you walk folks through these myths? Because you and I talked about this a bunch before also, if there's any time in folks' lives in which they will become nutcases about anything, it's in and around the pregnancy season. They want to do everything right. They want to dot the I's, cross the T's, get everything correct. So what are some of these common myths that float around out there, and how can we help folks navigate through that?
Yeah, so there's quite a few. We actually, in the program, go through many more than 5, but I've just chosen 5 of the ones that I think are the most prevalent out there. The first one is that doses of vitamin A, whether you get it through food or supplements, above 20,000 IU per day cause birth defects. And a lot of times people have heard me make recommendations for cod liver oil or eating organ meats, and one of the first reactions, particularly amongst women who are pregnant or thinking about conceiving, is, well, my doctor told me that I should avoid vitamin A because it's going to cause birth defects. So the first thing to know about vitamin A is that it's super, super important for reproduction. And we've known this for a long time. It promotes full-term pregnancy. It prevents prolonged labor. Promotes proper development of the face, especially the eyes and the nose and the dental arches and lips. Prevents deafness and internal organ displacement. It promotes kidney health, promotes lung health. I mean, it's really a crucial nutrient for reproductive health. And when you look at traditional cultures, for example, the Greenland Inuit, back in the 50s, before they'd had much contact with the modern world, they got about 35,000 IU of vitamin A per day. And that's, probably a similar range in a lot of traditional cultures. Historically, vitamin A intake was probably quite high during pregnancy, but a while back, there was a single study that supposedly found that mothers consuming more than 10,000 IU per day of vitamin A had 2.5 times greater risk of total birth defects and like a 5 times higher risk of cranial neural crest defects. But this study has been, you know, roundly criticized by several different groups of experts, and you know, I won't go into a lot of detail, I think we'd get off on a tangent, but you know, basically the author's classification of birth defects was really fishy. He underestimated the normal rate of birth defects in the overall population, which made the rate of defects in the study seem unusually high. And then there's about 7 or 8 other studies showing, you know, these are big, big sample sizes. You know, like one of the studies was over 500,000 births. You know, others were like 25,000. And they all show that doses of vitamin A between 20 and 40,000 IU actually either reduce the risk of birth defects or have kind of a no effect, but certainly are not causing any problems. The other thing to know, and I think we talked about this before, is that vitamin D and K2, which are the other fat-soluble vitamins, protect against vitamin A toxicity.
Right.
So, and this is an important piece that a lot of people miss, and it is one of the reasons why I recommend that people take cod liver oil. It's because it has vitamin A and D and K2 in the MK7 form, so it's got all and vitamin E, so it's got all the fat soluble vitamins that have that synergistic relationship. And we know, for example, that for a hypothetical 160-pound person, supplementing with vitamin D raises the toxicity threshold for vitamin A above 200,000 IU. So just to put that in perspective, 200,000 IU is a lot of vitamin A. I mean, 3 ounces of liver is about 27,000 IU. So you'd have to be eating like 8 or 9, let's see, you'd have to be eating about 25, 27 ounces of liver per day to exceed that. And I don't know anybody that gets even remotely close.
I've seen Greg attack a pile of pate in the past, but that would be rough.
It requires just too much bacon. It's not practical.
Yeah. So, you know, the takeaway from this is that vitamin A has several benefits in for, you know, reproductive health, fertility, and pregnancy and during breastfeeding. And in light of the fact that we know that over a quarter of Americans eat less than half the RDA of vitamin A, which is pretty inadequate as it is, 2,500 IU, and considering that it's not toxic, especially with adequate levels of D and K2, I usually recommend a dose of between 20 to 25,000 IU during pregnancy in order to, you know, boost reproductive health and prevent birth defects. And you can get that, as I said, you know, from eating organ meats, or you can get it from taking cod liver oil.
And Chris, you had a particular cod liver oil that you really like?
Yeah, I like the Green Pastures fermented cod liver oil because it's not heat processed, and as I'm sure most of your listeners know now, the fatty acids, the long chain omega-3 fatty acids, are very fragile and vulnerable to oxidative damage. And so whenever you process something like that with heat, it's going to, you know, damage those fragile oils. And the traditional way of processing cod liver oil was fermentation, and so there's only one company that I know of that's doing that, and it's Green Pastures. And so that, you know, that's the one I recommend. I also just want to briefly point out that there's another common misconception about vitamin A, which is that beta carotene and vitamin A are the same thing. And, you know, beta carotene is a precursor, an inactive form of retinol, which is the active form of vitamin A. And while we can convert some beta carotene, you know, from vegetables like carrots into retinol, only about 3% on average of beta carotenes get converted into retinol in adults. And that's assuming you're not one of the 45% of people that don't convert really many carotenes into vitamin A at all. So, you know, you can't really meet your vitamin A requirements just by eating vegetables.
And that's just a huge piece. If folks have any type of metabolic derangement or something like that, then that conversion is dramatically decreased. And folks may have heard of different studies, or they may be able to pull up, say, like on PubMed or through some searches, some stuff that indicates that vitamin A is a teratogen, which means that it causes birth defects. But again and again and again, these things are performed in situations in which there's inadequate vitamin D and vitamin K, like Chris said. Mm-hmm. So this is where looking at the nutritionism, looking at the individual nutrients, starts failing us. We really need to look at how these foods appeared in the foods that we typically ate. Look at the ancestral diet a little bit, and then kind of look at how these things occur in high concentrations, like in the organ meats or in the fermented cod liver oil, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And that's such a good point about food synergy. You know, we don't eat isolated nutrients. I mean, sometimes we supplement with them, but we don't eat them. And these nutrients always come with other nutrients that have sometimes opposing effects. And classic example of that is, you know, T. Colin Campbell's work, like correlating casein with cancer. And it's true that casein, when it's isolated, you know, the protein from milk can promote cancer. But what he neglected to point out was that whey, which is the other protein in milk, prevents cancer. So this is kind of like a net cancer-causing effect there.
So Little Miss Muffet had it right.
Yeah, exactly. Eat those curds and whey.
Eat the curds and whey.
So...
But that would suck for all the bodybuilding supplement companies at present, I guess, unless they're only selling whey protein. So
yeah.
So leading into protein, protein's another huge kind of blind alley in this scene. Particularly, I've seen this in the paleo crowd, in which folks are possibly for the first time in their life kind of eating higher amounts of protein, and they're feeling really good. They've got good blood sugar control. They've got good body composition. Woman gets pregnant, and then she's not feeling so good on that same protein intake. Chris, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I think a lot of pregnant women out there will relate to this, because naturally women become mildly averse to protein during pregnancy, most women. I think some women who go into pregnancy who haven't been eating a lot of protein sometimes crave it more, but I know a lot of women out there have had this experience. My wife definitely did. What happens is during pregnancy, urea synthesis is reduced, and urea is a waste product that's produced when the body metabolizes protein. So naturally, the body will crave less protein as a result of that reduced urea synthesis. And I know you probably saw this a while back, Rob. Lauren Cordain wrote an article suggesting that high protein diets, over 20% of calories, can be potentially harmful to the mother and the fetus. And there's some studies correlating high protein diets with elevated blood pressure. I recently saw a study suggesting that high protein diets can activate the HPA axis and raise cortisol levels. So what I usually tell women is that it's most people get enough protein during pregnancy. You don't need to worry too much about getting, you know, loads and loads of protein. The actual need is only about 10 to 15% of calories, you know, or maybe 50 to 75 grams if you're thinking about a 2,000 calorie diet. And that's basically like a quarter pound of beef plus maybe 6 ounces of salmon in a day. I think a bigger issue is a lot of women aren't getting enough healthy fats during pregnancy, or they're getting too much carbohydrate, especially fructose. So those are really the areas to focus on instead of, you know, eating too much protein.
I don't know if you will talk about this later, but something that folks is not widely understood is that ketone formation is actually critical for normal fetal brain development. And these ketone bodies actually end up being structural elements that go into fetal brain development. So if the individual is so insulin resistant or so cortisol laden, say from, you know, say like if the protein intake is too high, or if generally the individual is in kind of a metabolically deranged state, it can be very, very hard to produce ketone bodies. And so it's another additional stressor on the on the body trying to get these basic substrates that are necessary for normal brain development.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great point. So take it easy on the protein. I mean, I think most women, if they just follow their cravings, will be fine, because it's kind of hard to overeat protein. It makes we get nauseous when we do. So I think what I see happening is women naturally crave less, but they have this idea that they should eat more, and so they force themselves to eat more, and then that makes them nauseous. And there's kind of an idea out there that when you're nauseous during pregnancy, you should eat protein. You know, that's one of the sort of common treatments for nausea during pregnancy is to eat more protein. And I'm not so sure that's a good idea based on what we were just talking about.
Right. Right. You know, if there is a little bit of nausea going on, you know, the old standard of like the saltine crackers and all that stuff, like, have you cooked up a smart alternative to that, just trying to keep people away from gluten? Like, would you steer them towards like a rice cracker or something like that, just for that kind of crunchy sort of deal? Or
what my thing with nausea is, I think it's usually blood sugar related. Mm-hmm. So I have found that just by eating more frequently, that seems to help in most cases. And if that doesn't help, yeah, I mean, I think white rice is pretty hypoallergenic and pretty well tolerated by most people. Unless you know that you're not one of those people, I think eating a little bit of white rice, that something bland like that can be helpful, whether it's in the form of a cracker or just actually cooking some white rice and using it. But I found that regulating blood sugar by eating more frequent meals and, you know, making sure not to overtrain or undertrain, you know, that'd be too sedentary, that seems to make a big difference for most women.
I'm waiting for the question to come in. Rob, I'm a CrossFit Games competitor, pregnant, and want to intermittent fast 22 hours a day. What are your recommendations?
No.
Greg, have we received that one? Has that one come in here yet?
Probably. Yeah. Probably about a dozen times.
Yeah. Sweet. Yeah. Don't do that. That's bad news. No intermittent fasting during pregnancy, please.
Okay.
So the next one's pretty interesting, and it's one that I've been learning quite a bit about lately, because I've been tracking, you know, Elan's hemoglobin levels throughout pregnancy, partly just because I'm curious like that, and partly because, you know, it's recommended this every now and then to check in and see if a woman's how oxygen deliverability is going, or she's becoming anemic. Mm-hmm. And I've been kind of blown away, actually, by the lack of understanding of this in the conventional medical community. She went in to her she has an endocrinologist because she has an autoimmune thyroid condition. Not that the endocrinologist does anything for her, we completely manage it on our own, but she went in there, she got the standard blood test, and it came back, and her hemoglobin was 11, and this was at around 28 weeks, and the doctor told her she was anemic and told her to take iron. And of course she comes home and tells me that, and I test her iron levels, and her iron levels are, you know, at the higher end of the range. So number one, she's not iron deficient, and you know, there's many, many more causes of anemia than iron deficiency, and this nutritionally, B12 deficiency is more common cause of anemia in my experience. But number two, and this is the way more important thing, is that during pregnancy, blood volume expands by about 30%, and it's natural for women, the normal range for hemoglobin falls to 10 to 14 grams per deciliter at 28 weeks. So that was a perfectly normal drop in her hemoglobin levels, and the recommendation to take iron was not only unjustified, but actually potentially harmful, because there's a lot of studies that show that iron that routine iron supplementation can be potentially harmful for a couple of reasons. Number one, it has a lot of side effects, like you know, constipation and gastrointestinal distress. And number two, there are studies that show that high hemoglobin levels, like boosting hemoglobin levels to above 14, is actually associated with worse outcomes for birth. And that's because that increases the blood viscosity and then decreases the capacity of hemoglobin to deliver oxygen to the placenta and to the maternal, you know, the mom's tissues. So this idea that everyone should be taking, you know, all women should be taking iron during pregnancy is not accurate at all.
And there's also just the oxidative stress element of this. I mean, women are usually not as prone to this because, you know, normal menstrual cycle will kind of remove some of the iron content. But during pregnancy, that's a perfect time to actually get some iron accumulation and increase mm-hmm. oxidative stress, both on the mom and the baby.
That's right. Iron's a pro-oxidant. It's inflammatory. And, you know, on top of that, if you look at studies, like, so even when a woman falls a little bit below that 10 to 14 range of hemoglobin, which might indicate a very mild anemia, the studies have shown that supplementing with iron, even though it does raise hemoglobin and iron levels, has no detectable effects on any important clinical outcomes like, you know, preterm labor or birth weight or Apgar or anything like that. So it's another case where we're kind of interfering with what is generally a natural process, which, you know, of a woman, you know, who's pregnant having hemoglobin levels that are lower than a non-pregnant woman, and you know, throwing in an isolated, often synthetic nutrient, and just, you know, assuming that that's going to work out well. And what, you know, what these studies are showing is that it's not only unnecessary, it's potentially harmful. So, I mean, just want to say that there are cases of real iron deficiency and iron deficiency anemia in pregnancy, but they're pretty rare in the first world.
Cool.
Yeah,
I dig it.
Should we go on to the next one?
Yeah. So, you know, I obviously, like, I'm you know, usually recommending a paleo type diet, which, I mean, we're going to talk about a number of nutrients here in a second. Usually, that basic paleo type diet addresses, like, the iron issues, because we don't have gut health as a factor in absorption. Oh, you know what? I do want to back up one second here, just really quickly. When you checked your wife's iron levels, were you looking at ferritin relative to hemoglobin, or how did you check iron levels specifically?
Yeah, when I do iron panel, I do ferritin, TIBC, which is total iron binding capacity, UIBC, which is unsaturated iron binding capacity, iron saturation, and serum iron. And of all of those markers, serum iron is the least accurate and the least sensitive, meaning when a woman becomes iron deficient, the first marker that will go out of whack is total iron binding capacity. And that's, you know, the capacity to bind iron. So if you've got high total iron binding capacity, that means you could use a little bit more iron. And then the next one usually to go out of whack after that is ferritin. And so when we tested her at 28 weeks, all of those markers were completely normal. And the serum iron, if anything, was a little bit towards the high end of the range.
Right.
And then her hemoglobin was 11, which is perfectly within the 10 to 14 range. And actually this morning, before we got on the on Skype here, I pulled up the study, and it was suggesting that it was relation between maternal hemoglobin concentration and birth weight in different ethnic groups. And what the authors looked at, all different ethnic groups, you know, Africans, Asians, Mediterranean, Caribbean, white women, and they found that women with hemoglobin levels towards the lower end of that range actually had the best outcomes at birth. So,
interesting.
Yeah, it is. So, yeah, we're going to talk about paleo diet, and does eating a standard paleo diet give you everything you need to get pregnant? It's kind of a trick question, because it depends on a few things. It depends on what you consider to be a standard paleo diet, and there's, you know, a lot of variation out there. And then you know, it depends on the individual, because certainly for some people it is enough. But I think there are some nutrients that are difficult to find in doses or amounts that I consider to be optimal for, you know, fertility and pregnancy, that a typical paleo diet doesn't necessarily have. And those are vitamin A, which we already talked about. And if your paleo diet includes organ meats, then sure, you're going to probably get all the vitamin A you need if you're eating organ meats, you know, a couple times a week. But most people, I think, Rob, don't do that. I don't know, at least in my practice.
I think very, very few, and particularly I not to throw the chicks under the bus, but I think the females are less likely to eat organ meats than the dudes are in general.
Yeah. So, you know, the other one's vitamin D. Vitamin D is not very easy to find in food. It's pretty much in fatty cold water ocean fish, and you know, in very much smaller amounts in things like butter and mushrooms. But you'd have to eat about 16 pounds of mushrooms to meet your vitamin D requirements during pregnancy.
Greg had some stories along that line.
Oh yeah, how did that work out?
So far, fine. Apparently,
He ended up in New Orleans somehow, wearing some sort of like a chicken hat. So it was kind of wild.
Yeah, 16 pounds, huh? That'd be crazy. Yeah, so vitamin D and getting it from sun is sometimes possible and sometimes not, obviously, depending on the time of year, depending on where you live, and depending on your health status, because things like inflammation and obesity can decrease the conversion of you know, of sunlight to active vitamin D. So then there's lesser known nutrients like choline, biotin, and glycine, which all play an important role in pregnancy, and those are again available usually only through eating organ meats, and in the case of glycine, bone broth. And this has been discussed, you know, recently in the paleo world. Glycine is an amino acid that, you know, methionine, let me back up, is what we find in muscle meats and eggs, and a typical paleo diet would be high in, you know, in methionine rich foods. But glycine is found in the skin and bones of animals, and the thing about methionine is that it can increase the need for B12 and B6 and folate and choline and biotin and all these nutrients that we that a lot of women might be deficient in if they're not eating organ meat. So if you get this scenario where someone's eating like a lot of muscle meat and a lot of eggs and they're not eating any organ meats or any glycine-rich bone broths, that's kind of a recipe for a little bit of nutrient depletion, because you're not only not getting the nutrients from the organ meats and the bone broths, but you're eating, you know, methionine-rich muscle meats and eggs, which can deplete the body of those missing nutrients.
And, you know, there's another layer in this, if I could throw something in, which is that women are usually pretty conscientious, or the OBs are pretty conscientious about getting women on folic acid because of neural tube defects due to folate deficiencies. But it's been pretty interesting talking with Lauren Cordain, looking at some emerging research. But the way that we get folate in nature is in the form of folate, not folic acid. And there's a bunch of different kind of isoforms of this stuff. But what we're typically supplementing people with is folic acid, which actually saturates the body's ability to convert folic acid into folate in the liver very, very quickly. And then this strong methylating agent is then running loose on the rest of the body. And what this methylating agent can do, high levels of folic acid specifically, we're finding increased rates of breast, colon, and prostate cancer in folks.
Yep.
And so we've been supplementing our diet for close to 30 years now with folic acid in the hopes of reversing neural tube defects. Conservative statistical epidemiological analysis says that this nationwide supplementation with folic acid has probably reversed possibly about 8 neural tube defect events.
Thanks a lot.
And has possibly completely spiked this upsurge in breast, colon, and prostate cancers. So, Additionally, elevated folic acid levels, folate levels as an individual issue can mask B12 deficiencies, which then can mask iron deficiency issues. Mm-hmm. And so this is where, again, this nutritionism, and unless you do it smart, unless you have a smart orientation on this whole process and really look at filling in missing gaps in an intelligent way, then you can inadvertently supplement yourself out of one problem and into a whole slew of other problems.
That's such a good point. And you know, we talk about this in the Healthy Baby Code, and I've had some discussions with Matt Lalonde about this because he rightly slammed me for using the wrong terminology both of us, I guess. But so yeah, the folates, what you were just talking about, how folic acid, if you take folic acid, which is the form that's in almost all of the supplements, if you look on any, you know, most multivitamins, pregnancy multis, you'll see folic acid listed on there. And when that ends up unmetabolized in the serum, it causes all the, you know, all the problems that you just mentioned. And the other problem is that although it may be effective in reducing neural tube defects, and that's controversial, as you pointed out, it doesn't have all of the other effects of the natural tetrahydrofolates. So the thing about folates too is that the once again, you know, the highest dietary source is liver. So if people who aren't eating liver, who are on a paleo diet, are not probably getting enough. The other sources are legumes, which of course are not part of the paleo diet, and dark leafy greens. But to meet even the pregnancy RDA, which is 600 micrograms, I think it's a little bit too low. I advise more like 800 to 1200 micrograms with supplements and food combined. But even to meet 600 micrograms per day of folates, you'd have to eat 3 to 6 cups of dark leafy greens per day. So that's a lot of kale, you know. most people on a paleo diet aren't eating that. So this is definitely an issue, and I'm so glad you brought up the issue of folate. You know, if you're taking folic acid, that can mask both B12 and iron deficiency, which are a potential issue in pregnancy. So, yeah, I think that pretty much covers it for the you know, what you could add to the paleo diet to make it more pregnancy and fertility friendly.
So it's a good starting point, but obviously folks need to listen to their protein limitations, just kind of what their body's telling them to eat, and then also really need to consider either some supplementation or some addition of like some bone broth and you know, organ meats to try to round stuff out. Like if they want to go without some baseline supplementation, they need to be a little more fastidious about some of these other, like, not quite as culturally accepted foods,
right,
in like the northern America, North America, Europe, and all that stuff.
Not gonna find it at your average fast food joint.
Can I have a double with a side of bone broth, please? So, Chris, what about fish? People get freaked out about fish during pregnancy. Like, we're going to inundate the mother and the baby with mercury, and all hell is going to break loose. What's the deal with that?
It is. It's scary. There's again, a misunderstanding and a misconception here that's tied to some research that was a little bit misleading. Let me back up and just say first, you know, why fish would be important to eat during pregnancy, and then we'll talk about, you know, why some groups advise against it and why I think that's not a good idea. So I think the primary benefit, you know, in addition to other nutrients like selenium and vitamin D, and, you know, that we get from eating fish, the primary thing we're going for is DHA, which is the long chain omega-3 fat that's found pretty much exclusively in seafood. There's small amounts in the fat of ruminant animals, you know, like cows and sheep, but in really significant amounts in seafood. And it's DHA is it's preferentially incorporated into the brain as it rapidly develops, you know, in the early part of pregnancy especially, and then during the first 2 years of infancy. And it concentrates in the gray matter in the eyes. It's crucial for the formation of neurons, which are, of course, the functional cells in the brain, and to also protects the brain against oxidative damage. So studies have shown, there was an FDA report in 2008 that came out, actually, that showed that the nutrients in fish boosted a child's IQ by up to 10 points, which is significant. And in this report, the FDA suggested that pregnant women eat more than 12 ounces of fish per week, but Americans on average consume 5 ounces or less per week, which is, of course, less than half of what of the recommended amount. And about 15% of women who, of childbearing age don't eat any fish at all. So, of course, in some cases, the reason is people just don't like fish. But in other cases, it's because we've been told that, you know, fish are not safe to eat because they have high levels of mercury. But even beyond mercury, they've got PCBs and dioxins, and these toxins cause neurological problems, increase the risk of cancer, et cetera, et cetera. So let's see. It is true that mercury levels in fish are potentially harmful, but as it turns out, this is only the case if the fish don't have equally high levels of selenium. And selenium, it turns out, has a high binding affinity for mercury. And when selenium and mercury are found together, they connect and form a new substance. And that substance isn't well absorbed by humans. And in fact, studies show that selenium prevents the adverse effects from mercury toxicity. So if we go back to, you know, what I was saying about the research, there was one study, there's only a single study that showed adverse effects from mercury that came from seafood. And in that study, the people were eating pilot whale meat. Now, pilot whale meat's unusual because it contains more mercury than selenium, unlike most ocean fish. If you look at almost all ocean fish, they have more selenium than mercury, which means they're safe to eat. But pilot whale is one of the few fish, along with tarpon, marlin, swordfish, and some species of shark, that have more mercury than selenium. And certainly those fish should be avoided or minimized. But the rest of the fish, you know, the commonly eaten fish like salmon and tuna and things like that have more selenium than mercury, and therefore they're safe, not only safe to eat, but they're really beneficial.
So what would be some you mentioned salmon and tuna. How about like mackerel and sardines? Because they're even kind of smaller down the bioaccumulation scale.
Those are higher in DHA.
Yeah,
those are fantastic. Mackerel, herring, sardines, anchovies are all good choices. And of course, and shellfish too. Oysters are some of the most nutrient. It's one of the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet, along with some organ meats. So the other issue with fish, though, that we should at least mention is the whole dioxin and PCB thing. And those are synthetic compounds that are used in industrial processes like, you know, paper bleaching and stuff like that. And it's true that those have shown carcinogenic properties in animal studies. But the thing is, PCB and dioxin levels are 3 times higher in vegetables than they are in fish, and you don't hear people saying that we shouldn't be eating vegetables. And while eating fish could potentially result in a very small number of excess cancer deaths due to these toxins, that number is dwarfed by the number of deaths due to cardiovascular disease that's prevented by eating fish. So one study that I looked at showed that if you put this another way, that eating fish could cause an extra 2 deaths out of 100,000 people, but it would save 7,125 lives. So you got a net benefit of saving 7,123 lives there from eating fish. So I think it's really important for women to know that they should not only is eating fish safe, it's really important, has really important nutrients for the developing baby. And it's also super important for fertility because DHA and EPA, their studies have shown low levels of both of these fats in women who are infertile, and also studies that have shown low levels of DHA and EPA in the sperm of infertile men.
Chris, there's been some controversy around the EPA DHA supplementation, you know, kind of safe range. We're talking kind of pregnancy specifically, but what type of amounts do you want people getting either dietarily or supplementary per day?
Yeah, my recommendation for fish and DHA intake is 3 6-ounce servings of cold water fatty fish per week.
Okay.
And you know, it's this is assuming that the diet is low in omega-6. So if you're, you know, trying to limit your omega-6 from, you're following a paleo type of diet and you're not going crazy on the nuts, then 3 6-ounce servings of cold water fatty fish will give you about a 1-to-1 omega, you know, omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, or, you know, maybe 2-to-1, which is fine. But if you're, you know, cheating every now and then and you're eating a lot of nuts and your omega-6 intake is higher, then I would recommend boosting that. But that fish intake a little bit more, so you even out the ratio.
Cool.
It's all about the ratio.
Right. So just mainly focusing on that qualitative ratio, not being as worried about like an absolute or minimum limit on that.
Well, I think limiting it, you know, limiting total polyunsaturated fat intake to 4-5% of calories is a good idea. But I think also there's a little bit more leeway, you know, with pregnancy. So if you just on a really practical level, if you're not eating seed oils, if you're you know, having maybe a handful of nuts a few times a week instead of several handfuls a day, and if you're eating fish, you know, 6-ounce serving of fish 3 times a week, you're good. That's cool. Gonna do it. Yeah.
Okay. After this podcast, Nikki and I are running out and killing a all-you-can-eat sashimi buffet somewhere. We'll find one in LA and we'll destroy it. So
get your week's worth.
Perfect. Yeah. So, Chris, tell us a little bit about, you know, this has been like a mountain of information. Tell us about this overall product that you've developed, though, the Healthy Baby Code product, just like what all is in it, and, you know, we've done over, coming up on an hour already talking about this, and we haven't even scratched the surface of what's in this thing.
Okay. Yeah. So I started teaching, you know, when I did all this research, I just seemed like stuff that people needed to know, and I had learned a lot, and I wanted to share it. So I started teaching it as a local seminar in the Bay Area, and then I started to get a lot of requests from my, you know, readers and podcast listeners who don't live in the Bay Area to put it together into some format that they could access from, you know, wherever they are. And so that's what I did. I considered doing, you know, like a DVD type of thing with a paper guide, and then that just seemed like a hassle with shipping. So I made an online, I guess you could call it an online home study course. And so when you sign up for it, you get immediate access to it. You get lifetime access, and I'll be updating it in the future. And so if, you know, whoever gets it will get access to those updates. It's basically broken down into 6 core modules, and there each module has a video presentation, and then there's an MP3 recording of it and a PDF. So, you know, people have different preferences in terms of their learning style, but we talk about more about the traditional foods that cultures ate, you know, during preconception and pregnancy period. How to avoid some of the common complications during pregnancy, and how to approach infertility from a nutritional perspective. We talk about macronutrients, you know, how much protein, fat, and carbohydrate you need and your baby needs, you know, more along the lines of what we talked about earlier in the show. We talk about which fats are best for you and your baby, you know, which is the preferred carbohydrate source, stuff like that. Then we get really deep into micronutrients, and we covered some of that on the show today. We talk about all the micronutrients that are necessary, all the vitamins and minerals, and then where to find them in foods. I've got charts with, you know, to show you exactly what foods have what micronutrients, and you know how much of each food you need to eat to get the right amount. We've got a section on food toxins. The four that I consider to be the biggest problem are industrial seed oil, excess sugar, cereal grains, improperly prepared cereal grains, especially, and soy, processed soy. And then the module 5 is actually about breastfeeding and first foods. So how long should you breastfeed? What are the key guidelines for introducing foods in such a way that you can minimize the risk of allergies and food reactions and autoimmunity, which are becoming increasingly common, of course. And then in the last module, we put everything together into a really clear, focused strategy that can help boost your fertility and promote a healthy pregnancy and help you raise a really vibrant and beautiful baby.
That's awesome. I was just introduced to Chris less than a year ago, I guess, and then we started geeking out via email. We got the Kraken on our email thread, and he ends up kicking us in the balls more often than not on various topics. But I've had this idea kind of brewing of doing something pregnancy related, fertility related. Like, there was an obvious need here. Like, I saw kind of the results that we were getting in our gym and what I saw from people tinkering with this paleo approach, but there were so many loose ends, you know, like what foods do you introduce, what do you do during breastfeeding. And none of this information was well delineated by me, for sure, but it definitely wasn't consolidated in one spot. And then Chris told me about this project he was putting together, and I kind of looked at the outline. I was like, holy cats, okay, this is totally legit. And so Chris shot the beta element to me so I could kind of poke around on the back end and look at it, and it was just phenomenal. I was totally impressed with it. It's just a stem to stern approach to getting as healthy as you possibly can as a mom and as a father in a lot of ways, if you're looking at trying to get pregnant, and then stay as healthy as you can throughout pregnancy, throughout breastfeeding, introduction of the first foods so that you keep the gut health of the little ones in consideration there. It's totally an amazing system. Like, I feel like, who's the OxyClean guy? I feel like I need a beard and, like, you know, someday. But it's kind of like that. I mean, it's a seriously legit product. And both Chris and I have seen a lot of people who are on the back end of the reproductive medicine scene, like trying to get pregnant, having a lot of different difficulties, and looking at different nutrition and lifestyle factors, which were obviously leaving money on the table. Like, these folks were getting ready to pony up vast sums of money to do this standard medical intervention, and sometimes you just have to do even that. Like, you can have all your ducks in a row, and you may still need to step up to the plate and do that, but you would like to have as much of this stuff squared away as you possibly can before you head down that road. And hopefully getting all this stuff squared away, like Chris said, in his situation, his wife has an autoimmune condition, which was precluding pregnancy for quite some time. And then once you guys got that dialed in, then you were good to go. You guys are going to hatch a little one here in about 6 to 8 weeks, and you'll remember what sleep was.
Vaguely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the feedback, Rob. It was definitely a labor of love for me, and there's nothing like personal motivation, you know, to get the ball rolling, right?
Yeah.
So I've definitely really enjoyed our conversations, and I've loved coming on your show, and I want to offer something, you know, specific for your listeners. And I, you know, we talked about this, doing like a Q&A teleseminar for the first 100 people to sign up, where, you know, because people get in here, they watch the material, and I've tried to answer all of the questions that I could think of in advance, but of course there's going to be some questions I haven't thought of. And so we'd like to offer you guys who are listening now, the first 100 people who sign up, free access to a Q&A teleseminar with Rob and myself. And then another thing is that if you sign up before next Wednesday, so this is going to be aired on Tuesday.
Tuesday, the 10th? That sounds close.
No. I'm looking at the wrong month. Tuesday the 7th. Okay, so this is coming out. You're listening to this. Tuesday the 7th. If you buy the Healthy Baby Code before Wednesday the 15th, then you get entered into a drawing for two free lifetime access passes. So you've purchased it already. That means you get the full refund, and then you get a free pass to give to your friend or your sister or, you know, someone that you know that you want to turn on to this approach. So those are the two things: a free Q&A teleseminar for the first 100 people that sign up, and then entry into that drawing if you buy it within the next week. That will end on Wednesday at midnight. Yeah.
So folks will be able to grab this thing off of my site, robwolf.com/healthybaby, and we'll have a full page dedicated to that. And that thing will become a little bit of a living, breathing entity as this program develops and expands, as we get success stories and stuff like that, then that thing will start developing and expanding. But that's where folks can purchase this thing. And I think also something that Chris and I talked about just on the fly before we went on this podcast to record, in addition to the teleseminar, which the teleseminar is going to be for the first 100 people who purchase the Healthy Baby product, but in addition to that, I know that folks are just generally going to have a bunch of questions about this thing. So maybe we'll look, you know, maybe 4 to 6 weeks down the road after this podcast airs, and we'll get Chris back on here to talk not only about this, but just when I tweeted about Chris coming on the show, I was bum rushed by a ton of questions that people had that they wanted to bounce off of Chris. So maybe we could do like a 50-50 show talking about Healthy Baby specific stuff again, and then also just general wit and wisdom of Chris Kresser. So
yeah, I'd love to come back and do that. That'd be great.
Cool.
So yeah, thanks again for having me back on the show, Rob. It's been a pleasure as usual.
And so to those of you who do have questions specific to Mr. Kresser, when you submit them on Rob's site, put Chris Kresser's name in the subject line.
You'll
have a much better chance of those things actually getting fielded and potentially chosen to be used.
Sounds
right
good.
On.
So cool. It's robwolf.com/healthybaby.
Sweet. Don't slash the babies. Cool, yeah. Chris. Well, I know you're doing a little a brief little vacation here after we wrap this thing up and well deserved. So thanks for coming on the show, and I'm super excited to see where all the stuff goes.
Thank you, Rob. And thanks, Greg.
All right. We'll see you guys.
Talk to you guys soon.